The pandemic economy affects everything: fashion, movies and TV, the climate, and also apparently has a lot of people stuck on boats. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, September 24th. Good to have you with us. First up today, the internet. The Trump administration, not for the first time, proposed limits yesterday on the laws that shield tech companies from liability for what their users do online. This law has been controversial for a long time. The Trump administration and conservatives mostly claim that tech companies are using it to censor them. Their changes would make the law more narrow, but potentially allow more political speech and misinformation. But many privacy advocates and internet researchers think changes to the law should encourage social media platforms to take down more potentially harmful content and ads. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benisher points out, nothing is likely to happen very soon.
Internet companies' websites have two kinds of immunity. First, if you post something illegal on Facebook, let's say, like defamation, Facebook isn't legally liable, with certain exceptions. Second, if you post something legal on Facebook and it gets taken down, Facebook isn't legally liable if you're mad. Both of these immunities are being targeted by a collection of proposals from the White House, the Justice Department, and Capitol Hill. Daphne Keller is director of platform regulation at Stanford Cyber Policy Center.
If the first immunity were limited and platforms faced more liability for leaving up user speech that might violate the law, changing that would seriously change the internet as we know it.
Websites might have to hire legions of lawyers to assess allegations and figure out if user speech is illegal or not. Facebook's and Google's might be able to handle that. Smaller websites would probably not. And so Keller says sites would be incentivized to just take a lot more stuff down.
And so it becomes very hard to imagine things like the Me Too movement in a world where platforms are worried that they're going to be liable for defamation.
The DOJ's proposal targets the second type of immunity as well. It would effectively open up platforms to legal action if those platforms take down posts simply because they find them objectionable.
That is basically telling a private company that it could face all kinds of crackdowns if it doesn't participate in certain kinds of speech.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. A social media platform would be shielded from legal challenge if it took down unlawful posts or posts promoting terrorism, but could be sued if it wanted to take down something that was racist or untrue. In New York, I'm Sabri Benisher for Marketplace.
Now to a story of coronavirus consequences. The CEOs of some of the largest consumer products companies, Unilever, Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson, are weighing in on what they say is a question of human rights on the high seas. Because of coronavirus measures, some 300,000 people who work on commercial vessels, you know, the kind that carry food and health and hygiene products, among other things, are stuck on their ships, unable to leave. Governments around the world have closed ports, borders, and other travel facilities that allow crew changes. And not being able to change crews on these ships is a problem for the health and safety of workers, as well as a pretty good way to clog up supply chains. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Typically, commercial ship workers sign contracts of 6 or 10 or 12 months. And when that's up, the ships swap crews at the next port.
But whenever they came near the ports, the port is not allowing any kind of the transfer.
Bronco Berlin is with the International Transport Workers Federation. He says some workers have been stuck on board for 17 months, in that some ports accept products but not people. In one case, several ports refused to take the body of a ship worker who died.
And then we actually find the way that a body was taken in Singapore, and after 15 days on board a ship,
the issue of overworked crews is clogging up the supply chain. Tom Derry, CEO of the Institute for Supply Management, says officials in places like Australia are now starting to ban improperly staffed ships from sailing.
Because we're seeing these ships are sort of taken out of circulation, as it were, we've seen rates for freight crossing the Pacific more than quadruple since June.
He says delays are causing fridge and dishwasher shortages in the U.S., and keeping goods moving is critical to the multinational firms that are now pressuring the UN to get involved. The group is the Consumer Goods Forum, and Didier Bergeret is director.
We can't face the risk of global supply chains being disrupted, and all of this at the expense of workers' well-being.
Meantime, the workers remain mostly invisible, says Andrew Kinsey. He's a marine risk consultant at the insurer Allianz.
When you go into a store and you look at items on the shelves, the way they got to that shelf was via ship. As a consumer, we're blind to it.
But 80% of the goods in the world are delivered by sea. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, yesterday we told you how even while Washington can't get a relief deal done, everyone from the Fed to the Business Roundtable seems to know the economy isn't rebounding. Today we got new unemployment numbers showing that another 870,000 people filed for unemployment last week, up from the week before, and the 27th straight week of record high jobless claims. That is bad. And the virus, by the way, is rebounding in Europe and the UK. However, today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said they are at least open to discussing more financial relief. That saved markets from another big bad day. Details in the numbers. There is, I have to acknowledge, a lot to feel down about right now. Racial injustice. Protests reignited this week after no police officers were directly charged in the killing of Breonna Taylor in Kentucky. The pandemic and all its effects, and of course, fires and hurricanes across the country. And these things, as it turns out, are all related. Race, the economy, climate change, public health. And a new book co-edited by Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson and Catherine Wilkinson connects those dots with a focus on climate change and on doing the work to fix it. It's called All We Can Save, Truth, Courage, and Solutions for the Climate Crisis. And it includes essays, poems, and art by more than 40 women leading the climate movement. Ayanna and Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us. So great to be here.
This is not the type of climate change book you expect. It's storytelling, it's beautiful.
Surprise.
And right, exactly. And when did we find ourselves at a point where we stopped talking about climate as the thing we live, you know, the air we breathe, the rain mm-hmm. that falls or doesn't fall? Ayanna, I'll start with you. Do you think it's important to recenter the conversation as a human problem?
Yeah, and even more so, a problem caused by a very small group of humans who made some horrible mm-hmm. decisions on behalf of the rest of us, right? Like, one of the problems with the environmental movement is that it has allowed the fossil fuel industry to spread the blame across all of us. You know, BP created this concept of a carbon footprint that we're now all obsessed with, instead of thinking about how we can focus on systems change, how we can transform our energy and transportation and buildings and agriculture and land use and manufacturing. That's the work that needs to be done, not just all of us, you know, not emitting anything, because that doesn't work. I mean, we've seen during the pandemic that even at the beginning, when people were all basically staying home, that emissions only went down 7 or 8%. So the whole individual responsibility thing is not going to get us there. And so this book puts forward a more collective vision.
Mm-hmm. We are a business and economic show, and we can't, of course, leave out how our economic system, Ayanna, you just touched on this a little bit, it's corporate emissions. Mm-hmm. How much of this storytelling is also about making the simple economic argument that saving people also saves money?
It's not a major theme in the book. Mm-hmm. Catherine, did you want to talk about our one main finance essay from Regine?
Sure. Yeah. So we were really excited to collaborate with Regine Clement, who runs Creo. And she's grappling with the question, how do we use the current economic system? How do we use extractive capitalism to transform extractive capitalism? So I think that the tricky thing to me is that the rules of the game have to fundamentally change. We can't just play the game better. I don't think that will get us to the kinds of radical emission cuts that need to happen this decade and then beyond. But there's clearly a really strong economic case for climate solutions.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the book is full of women, and a lot of them are women of color. And I feel like
it's our binder full of climate women.
It's your binder full of climate women. I feel like this conversation about racial justice, climate justice, social justice, the importance of involving women in these conversations, how mm-hmm. many women are leading solutions all over the world, is still kind of new and still kind of nascent.
Which is so lame, but you're right.
Which is pretty lame. But maybe take some explaining, you know, like what is this relationship between racial justice and climate change? And why don't people understand that?
I think we don't understand it because we don't want to, because it complicates something that is already really hard, right? Like that's the pushback that I hear most often. It's not like I'm a racist and I want to save the planet. It's more like solving climate change is hard enough without bringing in all these other layers. Can we just please focus on climate change now first, and we'll deal with like police not murdering black people for no reason later? And the answer is no. Mm-hmm. No, we can't. We have to walk and chew gum on this one. And there are many reasons for that. One is just it's the right thing to do. And so I hate having to give other reasons. But one of those other reasons is, you know, we know from polling by Yale and George Mason universities that people of color actually are more concerned about the climate crisis. But how, you know, how can we expect black people to be focused on climate solutions when making sure they have the basic right to live and breathe? And so this "I can't breathe" has become a rallying cry across, across the racial and climate justice groups, that it's not just in relation to police brutality, but in the ways that communities of color are burdened with more polluted air, and where power plants decide to locate themselves. And then, you know, people who are breathing that dirty air being more at risk for extreme forms of COVID. And so, of course, these things are all connected. And wouldn't it be great if we were building the winning team by including the people who were already on board and wanted to help?
Mm-hmm. And I just want to add that when we think about climate change as quote unquote the problem, I think mm-hmm. that's where we start to miss these intersections and entanglements. When we understand actually mm-hmm. that climate change is a manifestation of the mm-hmm. problem, right? It's emerging out of a system that we're getting so much feedback that it's not working. Racial violence is part of that feedback. Massive wealth inequality is part of that feedback. Mm-hmm. The epidemics of loneliness and meaninglessness are part of that feedback. But if we're just thinking about climate change as the problem we need to solve, then our analysis isn't deep enough about what's actually going on here, and thus what it's actually going to take to solve it.
Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson and Catherine Wilkinson are co-editors of the new book, All We Can Save: Truth, Courage, and Solutions for the Climate Crisis. Thanks so much, you two.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
In addition to their role as editors, Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson is the founder and CEO of Ocean Collective. Catherine Wilkinson is the editor-in-chief of Project Drawdown. They have also started a nonprofit called the All We Can Save Project. There's a link at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Hang on a second. It's pretty empty here.
Yeah, it's a little empty everywhere. But first, let's do the numbers. They pulled out a win. The Dow Jones Industrial rose 52 points, 2/10 of a percent, to finish at 26,815. The NASDAQ added 39 points, 0.3% and at 10,672. And the S&P 500 found 9 points, about 0.3%, to land at 3,246. More details on those unemployment insurance claims figures from the Department of Labor. That 870,000 for the week that ended September 19th, that was an increase of about 4,000 claims from the previous week. For the week ending September 12th, the states that saw the largest increases in initial claims were Kansas, Indiana, Illinois, and Michigan. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 0.66%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. All right, some positive thinking here. Movies and TV might be coming back. After months of wrangling, Hollywood studios, talent, and trade unions have reached an agreement on how to safely restart production. Some filming has already been happening months into the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. There are safety protocols on set decided on a case-by-case basis. Now this larger agreement comes after months of back and forth over how the hard-hit film and TV industry should get back on its feet. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has more.
Hey, fans. It's looking better for dozens of shows that halted filming, like Stranger Things. A new agreement between unions and studios includes guidelines for diligent use of personal protective equipment, instructions for crews to be grouped into zones according to proximity to cast, and everyone's ability to physically distance. It took several months to get there. One of the major sticking points in negotiations was COVID-related expenses, which aren't small. Shooting of the movie Jurassic World Dominion reportedly required 27,000 COVID-19 tests. That's around $3 million. Jason Squire is the editor of The Movie Business Book. He says, yeah, even on smaller productions, it adds up. COVID means extra personnel, COVID advisors, and...
The other issue is insurance. There is still no blanket policy that includes COVID-19.
But the new agreement has more assurances for actors and other employees on set. Under the new terms, those who get sick will receive up to 10 days paid, and those who must quarantine will also get paid. Actress Emma Ramos is happy about the clear guidelines. She's back on set and just filmed her first intimate scene since the pandemic. She says everyone is tested regularly still.
I was hesitant.
They rehearsed with masks. They got one take, then...
applause, and then obviously immediately again with a nurse, and then another test.
Back to reality. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
I will forgive you if you haven't noticed, what with all the yoga pants and the dirty t-shirts, that we're actually in the middle of Fashion Week season. New York's and London's have wrapped up, Milan's is going on right now, and Paris's will round out the sequence next week. At all four events, the runway shows have been scaled back, socially distanced, and mostly virtual. An indication of how the fashion industry, like so many others, is trying to make sense of a world under lockdown. Marketplace's Erica Barris takes us there.
In the program for his New York Fashion Week event, designer Tom Ford wrote that at the height of stay-at-home orders, he felt fashion should simply go into hibernation for a year. He's not alone in that thought. Susan Scafidi with the Fashion Law Institute at Fordham says these Fashion Week shows are...
in some ways, a placeholder.
Because...
at the moment, the way we dress is really the way we don't dress anymore. Fewer places to go, fewer formal events, a significant percentage of people still working from home.
She says that means designers and the companies that distribute clothes have to evolve. Last week, Rent the Runway, known for leasing workwear and formal wear, said it's getting rid of its unlimited subscription. Retailers that sell high fashion have shuttered. Supply chains have been backed up. NYU luxury marketing professor Tamai Sadari says theirs...
a general feeling of uncertainty, right? We don't know where we're going to manufacture the product. We don't know what the product will look like. We don't know what our life will look like to even imagine the product.
The products for now on the virtual runway, couture masks, flowier, comfier clothes, and home decor. Fashion Institute of Technology professor Letitia Brown says designers are using this time to rethink what they want to create and what consumers will buy. Brown says her own style has changed now that she spends lots of time on video calls.
I'm looking at neckline. So am I wearing a crew neck or V-neck? I want to make sure perhaps my necklace is a statement necklace, something that they can actually see.
That's influencing what she and other shoppers have been buying. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Now to Thailand, where tourism is a cornerstone of the economy. In 2019, according to an annual report from MasterCard, Bangkok had more international visitors than any other city in the world. The pandemic has brought a lot of that to a standstill, which means trouble for the people who work in Thailand's tourism industry. That brings us to today's edition of our series, My Economy.
My name is Nat Opasanon. I'm the owner of Your Thai Guide, a private tour guide service in Bangkok. Well, currently I'm in my living room in the countryside of Thailand, away from everything in the world right now. Your Thai Guide is a private tour guide service that we target for a small group of people, like a single person or a group of family. Everybody had the same interest on what they want to see and what they want to do on the day. We actually feel we know about this COVID news since January, February. So we start to be like, okay, something is happening, but we don't think it's going to affect us. Until like March, that's when like, oh, hang on, in Thailand, we have people that got infected of this, and then the government start to freak out and the whole world start to freak out. But in the back of my head, I still be like, hey, it probably gonna last like maybe 3 months. But well, 6 months passed, we still not open our country properly. So I was wrong. Well, Bangkok right now still look normal. Until you go into the tourist area, which is the old town where the palace and the temple is, that is the one that you start to like realizing that, hang on a second, it's pretty empty here. And you start to see cafe, restaurant start to shut down, selling their business. Like you see a lots of place hanging the sign for sale up. And that's very depressing in my opinion. It start to get uncomfortable to see my bank account right now just because we didn't have any income. We didn't take any customer for any tour for 6 months straight. But I still have my second job, which is a dog trainer, but it's still not a main income. And from what we see on the news, we don't think everything will be back to close to normal within this year. It might be back to normal, maybe mid next year, which is going to be another 6 more months. So it started getting to a worry point.
That was Nat Opasanon outside Bangkok. Whether you're in the U.S. or abroad, let us know how your economy is doing. You can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, you know what? Look, there's only so much we can stand. We are headed into the holiday season, and we don't even know if we'll be trick-or-treating for Halloween. The CDC says maybe neighborhoods are trying to figure out safe practices, how to work masks into costumes. But you know one thing that is not negotiable? The candy. Industry analysts say sales of Halloween candy are up 13% over last year. Sales of Halloween chocolate alone are up 25%. Not that we're eating our feelings or anything. All right, we got to go. Here's your economic context on a Thursday. Pandemic or unrest or climate or politics, be danged. Americans are buying houses like gangbusters. New home sales surged to their highest level since 2006 in August. But hey, that last housing boom turned out just fine, right? Look, I'm just saying, it's a little weird. Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.